God, it's like a sauna in here.
Welcome to TWT FM, a weekly podcast from the world transformed, bringing year-round radical political education and utopian thinking to bear on the issues that define our world. In our second series, we're exploring the concept of leisure, and in particular, aspects of life we've been missing due to the COVID crisis. What does leisure time reveal about our relationship to work and time under capitalism, and how our lives might be different with access to more of it? Join us as we delve into our favourite leisure activities, including football, holidays and more, with the wide-angle lens you'd expect from TWT. As ever, please subscribe and share the podcast with friends if you haven't already. For now though, turn up your headphones, sit back and listen up. This is The World Transformed.
It doesn't come cheap, but if you skimp on a spa, you might as well be at the municipal baths.
Welcome back to this week's episode of TWT FM. On our journey through our favourite leisure activities, we've danced on picket lines, watched a game of footy, and had one too many pints at our local. So for the last leg of our tour, we think we should take things a little easier, kick back, relax, and make a well-deserved trip to the sauna. Spas, saunas and bathhouses may not appear to be the most obvious leisure spaces that the left should make an impassioned case for. In its contemporary form, the term oozes with a neoliberal self-indulgence of seaweed wraps and gold foil face masks, crisp white bathrobes in five-star hotels, the highly sanitised spaces attributed to and for the rich. But what this impression of the spa misses is its rich and complex history across cultures, one imbued with a democratic and communal spirit. Spas, saunas and bathhouses are leisure spaces in which personal and intimate acts become communal, in which our bodies are attended to and cared for, washed and bathed in the company of others. At TWT, we feel it's really important to think about the ways in which we experience leisure on this bodily level, and how the spa, bathhouse and sanitarium has been utilised for decades to heal, to relax away from workplaces, and which have also defined our rituals around cleanliness. With its emphasis on physical equality, mutual self-care and letting go together, there is something about bathhouse culture that troubles rigid notions of masculinity. There are rich working class traditions centred around the spa, from spaces to bathe after long days on factory floors, to gay saunas which are key sites of queer culture. Yet the latter incarnations of the communal spa have been under continuous threats by property developers, seizing land in our cities and privatising these heightened spaces of relaxation. There are multiple iterations of the sauna and bathhouse throughout history. You may have once before visited the crumbling facade of a Roman or Greek bath. Around 300 BC, public bathing became entrenched in the very fabric of Roman society for both rich and poor. Men and women bathed together, with the bath becoming a key site to socialise and to discuss politics. By the 7th century, the bathhouses of antiquity had migrated to Turkey, where baths named hammams were born. Hammams are spaces where key life events are to be celebrated, and bathing rituals integrated into marriage and birthing ceremonies. Hammams consist of a steam bathroom with a large marble stone at its centre, where bathers lay as attendants scrub them and administer massages, a warm room for bathing and a cool room for resting. The use of heat to remove toxins from the body dates back to early Neolithic times, where caves were kept warm by a fire burning inside them beneath a pile of stones during the day. In Japan, onsens, which are natural hot springs formed by its volcanic activity, are spaces for rejuvenation and spirituality, dating back to when Buddhism first spread across Japan in the 6th century. Yet sauna is a Finnish word and is entwined in its national culture. In Finland today, there are around 3 million saunas for a population of 5 million, and on average, Finns take at least one sauna a week, and more often in the summer months. Traditionally, saunas, which occupied a room in one's house, were used as a site of purification before marriage ceremonies, and was the preferred birthing room as the naturally bacterium-resistant soot made it the cleanest room in the house. The vapour produced by throwing water over hot stones is called loily and determines the enjoyability of the sauna, as each sauna has its own distinct loily. In Finland, even in its parliament, has an in-house sauna where diplomatic matters are discussed within its steamy confines. Across the Soviet landscape, sanatoriums were built as palaces of rest, their constructivist splendour now adorned in glossy coffee table art books. They use an array of innovative and obscure methods, from crude oil baths to lying in magnetic sands. These techniques were informed by the Soviet medical science of curatology, the belief in reconnecting with nature, its healthy effects on the body, and a way to resist social alienation. In this sense, the sanatorium blurred rest, leisure, and medical treatments through a constructed timetable of wellness activities that also functioned in the crafting of a Soviet subjectivity. The 1922 Labour Code prescribed 2 weeks holiday a year for many workers, and the right to rest was enshrined in the 1936 Constitution for all citizens of the USSR. And the sanitarium became the place to exercise such a right through its emphasis on relaxation. In the time of COVID, we're doing as much as we can to protect our bodies from the threat of infection. This has inevitably shifted the way we feel about cleanliness, and we can only speculate what this means for the communal spa, baths, and saunas. But as we're ever more attuned to the ills of chronic conditions, particularly highlighted by long COVID sufferers, we believe that paying attention to the integral methods of these spaces can offer new ways to imagine a far more utopian and egalitarian way of dealing with the vulnerabilities of illness and ageing at the level of the community. Where the physical health benefits of heat and cold are well known, the mental and emotional effects of saunas are less well reported. It was found in 2018 that men who sauna bathed several times a week had a 78% reduced risk of developing psychosis in later life, compared to those who didn't. Beyond their relaxing atmosphere, sauna baths are believed to increase the release of feel-good endorphins to create an entirely natural antidepressant. As a result, most individuals who have been involved in sauna studies report increases in mood and well-being after as little as one sauna session, and many make sauna bathing part of their weekly schedule. So although we don't believe saunas, bathhouses, and steam rooms can fix the multitude of social ills under capitalism, we do think these spaces of relaxation can reorientate our attitudes to how we care for our bodies and each other, of ageing and chronic and mental illness. We call for something of a national spa service, with a sauna in every community, to provide a space of healing and togetherness, away from the demands of work. In this episode, we dip our toes into various aspects of what we term spa culture, that spans the bathhouse, spa, sauna, steam room, and sanatorium. We are helped along the way by Julian Serravo, who leads the urban design team at Autonomy, a think tank that explores the future of work. Along the way, you'll be listening to some clips from a short film titled The Baths, which was directed and edited by Anushka Sams and Sophia Panucci McQueen. The film beautifully explores masculinity and the caring rituals of bathing at the New Docklands Russian Banya and Steam Bath in East London, where we will also hear from Wayne Gruber, who is the founder, trustee, and director. Firstly, Julian speaks to Sarah Anand, multidisciplinary designer and researcher, about the construction of the bathhouse in London, not only as a social infrastructure, but what its architecture reveals about the politics of cleanliness both in and outside of the home.
So Sarah, you've done some work on essentially reintroducing the bathhouse into the urban fabric of London. Has this always been like this? Has London's habits of bathing and cleaning always been these? Or has there been another moment?
There has been a different time, really. And this is the period when, imagine massive industrialization happening and people moving to the city for work. London was divided into this class system of migrants living in these rookeries and these settlements that were cheap, they were overcrowded, and you could give away tiny rooms away because it was cheap for them to live there, much like what we have in London now, but of a completely different way where they lived almost like a community together. So there were some good things, but also bad things in the sense that when it came to the sanitary aspects of living together, there was a lot of issues because they would not have proper infrastructure in terms of the sewage infrastructure, hence no good access to water, you know, in terms of maintaining their body care. And so this was something that was seen as an issue by the philanthropists as well as reformers of the time in terms of A, ensuring London did not have any health hazards.
In a sense, this is a moment in which the public nature of health becomes apparent to people, yes?
Yes, yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So what's the idea that the solution that they were proposing was a sort of a privatization of those practices?
There were some things that was about privatization, which was when they developed the family home.
Which also, has its own bathroom.
Which has its own bathroom.
Okay, okay.
But there was also this other moment in terms of saying where we cannot provide the home as the only piece of infrastructure, we would also have community bathhouses. So there were these two sort of infrastructures that existed within the city. There was a system of public bathing, and also toilets had been introduced by then that were coming up. But there were, again, no toilets for women. They were very gendered because the city was at large for men to occupy and not for women to occupy. So most of even the public toilets that came out were largely for men. But you had the bathhouses and the washhouses. And if you look at the earlier plans, it's very interesting to see that there is a class within it, but then there's also gender within it. And most of the washhouses were actually, even if you look at the images, were occupied primarily by women. You don't really see men in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these were the facilities essentially that London started introducing. And there's been, over a period of time, a change in what this facility essentially meant. Like, the public bathhouse and the washhouse soon became a space for the community to gather. It became, if you go down the line in after even the war, is like when they started building more sports facilities, and also when they were thinking of the Olympics, where the swimming pool came in, and it's suddenly now what we see as the leisure center, where all these sports facilities have come together. But there was also the reason why the bathhouses don't exist anymore is because the bathroom exists in the home now, so you don't necessarily need it in the city itself. And that's in many ways been the reason for the privatization of the toilet in the bathroom.
Gay bathhouses, popularized in the US in the 1950s, were key sites for queer culture to exist, but they were also tarred by a long history of police raids and repression. The first recorded raid of a gay bathhouse in the US was in 1903 at the Ariston Bathhouse, where 60 men were detained, 11 were charged with felonies, and 37 were eventually arrested. In 1969 at the Dover Hotel in LA, one raid of the bathhouse ended with the brutal murder of Howard Efland by police. These raids condemning such spaces continue to this day, and these dedicated sites of relaxation, affection, and the possibility of sexual encounter are also in rapid decline. Here in the UK, Chariots in Vauxhall, Europe's largest gay sauna, announced in January this year that they were shutting for good as the company goes into liquidation. Gay saunas are therefore not immune to the gentrifying processes and discrimination other LGBTQI+ spaces face. To think through this wider context of gay saunas as spaces in continual decline, Julian speaks to Alessandro Brava, an architect and collaborator of Autonomy, who reflects on his experiences of gay saunas as both an important site for gay culture, but also one of a complex sexual politics.
I'm Alessandro Brava. I'm an architect based in Naples, and I have been collaborating with Autonomy in different ways. I had a conversation with a friend and former collaborator of mine, and we were recalling this story when we visited Cologne for work, for a project, and we went to this gay sauna, and he was remembering that he just found someone who wanted to give him a massage and give him a very long massage, and he was obsessed with his feet. So he spent like a couple of hours getting this foot massage. Recalling this experience, I remember one of the things that struck me the most was seeing how actually there were quite a few people who seemed to be living there in the sauna for like a few days. I don't know how long, but it was kind of people who perhaps like migrants who like didn't have like a fixed home who would live there for a period. There has been actually a lot of discussion about these queer spaces, such as like gay bars and gay saunas, and yeah, why they're disappearing. So I've been thinking about this, and I have a couple of things to say. I think the first one is that perhaps on the one hand, it can be read as a symptom of like increasing integration and less discrimination, that we don't need as much spaces that are dedicated to a specific community. On the other hand, I am also wary of the idealization and kind of exotization that is often done in conversations about these kind of spaces and their disappearance, because they are sort of heralded as spaces of freedom, so sexual freedom mostly, especially from straight people who perhaps don't have so much like an insight into what actually goes on in these spaces. And yeah, so I'm wary of this kind of idealization, because these spaces are very much born out of discrimination, first of all, and also from a need of exploring one's sexuality beyond often what are the traumas that one encounters growing up in a homophobic or discriminatory society. So this need for spaces that are designed around sex is something that I would question, actually. And I think if on the one end, yes, you know, sexual liberation is, of course, a conquest and an amazing sign of progress. On the other hand, I think dedicating spaces to a specific community for that, for this purpose, as I said, two sides. You know, one is, yes, liberation, sexual freedom, and the other is necessity of sort of experiencing affection and sex in, without any other sort of, with, you know, detached completely from socialization or emotions or other things that come with sexual interaction.
Thank you to Julian, Alessandro and Sara for their contributions on some historical and cultural interpretations of the bathhouse and saunas. You've already heard some of the sounds that depict the liveliness and communality of the new Docklands Russian Banya and steam bath in East London. The film The Bath captures how the multiple communities come together, from the East End's Black British, Eastern European, Jewish and White British communities, who visit the steam bar regularly to bathe and also chat and eat together. In the film, you'll see moments where within the foggy blur of the steam, a man is picking out watermelon seeds from a slice and sharing drinks. We talked to Wayne Gruber, founder, trustee and director, to discuss the history of the steam bath as a site for blue-collar workers to bathe and wash after work on the docks, and what traditional treatments such as schmeissing are used.
If I tell you a little bit about the history of actually the East End, firstly, and also the new Docklands, what we have now is the Russian Banya and steam baths. So back in the day, the main work was the East India docks, and much of the residents of the East End all worked somewhere in between the docks or connected to the docks. To follow on, there was again very sparse facilities, and in most households there were no bathrooms as we know them, and there was an outside toilet. So the council created something like 15 to 18 what they called bath houses. And those were derived from the waste product of actually heating a swimming pool. So this is how the steam facility as we know it came about. So the surplus production of heat for the swimming pool, heated swimming pool, was also then diverted to use as the laundry, so very cheap laundry for the residents, and then secondly to create steam rooms. And so there was, I say, about 18 in the East End. Now, over time, the docks closed and the improvements and grants were made for residents to actually install bathrooms. And then obviously new designs and new homes and new houses, everybody had a bathroom. So there was this decline in what was a bathhouse. And initially they were meant to be places where the dock workers would go from work, go to the bathhouse, bath, shave, shower, whatever, change their working clothes into clean working clothes, and they would then go home in those clothes and then return to work the next day wearing those clothes, if that makes sense. And every day they would visit the bathhouse. So if we jump now to the main one I can talk about is East Ham Baths, which was a massive establishment, swimming pool, loads of laundry facilities, and down in the basement was the steam bath, as we knew it. Took about 250 to 300 people, and always packed out. Mostly blue-collar workers and a sprinkling of professionals. You might get lawyers there, you'd get solicitors and accountants, but few. It was a place of villainy, and so there were all sorts of villains. People would come in with items of stolen goods, Harrods towels, razor blades, everything that you could possibly think of might be available on different days, you know, in that place.
After the council did an audit and found financial irregularities, they closed down the bathhouse. A number of users, including Wayne, worked with a local businessman and awarded the contract for dismantling the space to rescue and repurpose the equipment.
The dismantling took place, and then, of course, we didn't know where to put the items. We were trying to find a building, and we found what is now this building, completely empty, boarded up, and we couldn't get any information. The council couldn't tell us who the owner was. We didn't know who the landlord were, and so we were stuck actually squatting. So we broke into the building, and we stored all these pieces of boilers and showers and seats and everything you could imagine that we'd managed to take from the council. And we waited about 2 months, checking every week to see if anyone had changed our padlock. And after 2 months, decided, okay, it's safe to start. So a collective of people built the original New Docklands Baths as we know it. I'd like to now just run through basically the culture of the facilities. Now, it's a basic steam bath, so it's not a spa. It's utility, it's clean, it's sanitized, it's functional, but there's no colored lights and pipe music and anything else. It's exactly what you see is what you get. So traditionally, we only had something called a schmeiß. And that obviously came from the old days of the bathhouse for the dockers. So the dockers would come to the various steam baths around. Most of them were municipal council facilities. And the idea was they'd wash each other because they'd be covered in oil and muck from the docks. And so they made various brushes. Some would unravel ship's rope, for example, and make that into a mop or a brush. Others would find small ropes, rather like a, you know, a commercial mop. And over time, someone brought the idea of a seagrass or raffia. So the traditional schmeiß derives from the Jewish and Russian cultures. And schmeissing is, in Jewish terms, the removal of fat. In an abattoir, you actually schmeiß the piece of beef and you take this layer of fat. And that's basically the process of swinging the schmeiß as we do in the steam bath. So we changed then from these makeshift brushes and mops and towels, and we end up with a schmeiss. And various people, again from the docks, have crafted how to make the perfect schmeiss. So they get the rough raffia. It's tied up in the center. It's turned over itself, and that forms the handle. It's then wrapped in butcher's cord or butcher's string. And again, that's used because it doesn't stretch. So once the butcher's string is wrapped around the handle, it's very solid, and it can stand the heat, it can stand the water, dampness, and everything else. And the process was to be usually groups of people. So they'd be groups of the same, from the same job or the same company or the same friends, and they would collectively look after each other. This is the old way as it was, you know. And so we move on then to the arrival of Eastern Europeans. Men and boys arrived asking, could they use our facility? And from there, over those years, like 15 years now, we've had a steady increase by word of mouth. And actually the clientele has shifted. So much more open, much more friendly. Because in the early days, and particularly the old bathhouse in terms of East Ham, that was a very cliquey place. You were uncomfortable, and you could be made uncomfortable by these people. You walk into the restroom, they stop talking. Obviously, I'm glad to say that's gone. So we end up with two basic treatments that is the Vennik, the Schmeiss and the Vennik. So I'm going to explain the Schmeissing quickly, which is a large bucket, boiling water, cream, soap, something like Dove, and this Schmeiss that's been pre-treated. We spin it round, we make as much lather as possible, and we put that into the steam room. And the lucky person is the first to go down. So they go down, cold towel on the head, and then we put as much soap as possible on the body and as much soap as possible on the Schmeiss. And the saying goes, the more soap, the better the Schmeiss. And obviously that makes sense because you're not scoring yourself and scratching yourself with the raffia, because the soap is actually the protector, you know, between the skin and the rough raffia. And so the body is split up in four usually, and in a group, one does one quarter, comes out, they change the towel, the next one runs in, does the next quarter. So the body is effectively four quarters, two shoulders, two legs. And some people want the front as well. So that's another complication because there's another team needed to do that. And by the time they've finished, everyone will have done some work and got the Schmeiss and had some fruit juice or fruit and relaxed with enough time that they, when it's their turn to do the work, you know, they're comfortable. So the Vennik is basically leaves, either silver birch or oak leaves, sometimes eucalyptus. And the same principle is they're swinging the Vennik above the body. So they're bringing the heat from the ceiling down onto the body. And once they're hot enough, and the body is hot enough and burning, the Eastern Europeans believe that the oils in the leaves can be transferred to the joints of the body. So they would start on the shoulder, they do the elbow, the hand, they do the buttocks, they do the knees, and they do the feet. So that is the idea, that these natural oils are actually being transferred into the body. The same principle applies. There's usually a group, and as you do one quarter, you're basically exhausted and you actually need to get out to breathe. So one leaves, another one joins, and the whole process carries on until every member of the gang or the group have all had a Vennik. That usually means they might do that two or three times. So they might repeat this whole process three times, as do the guys with the Schmeiss. They will not just do one Schmeiss, they might have two or three Schmeisses in a session. So it's real hardcore sort of stuff. I mean, in terms of stamina, you really need to have, you know, excellent stamina to be able to keep up with the gang and to keep up with what you're trying to do.
Thank you to Wayne Gruber for those fascinating insights into the world of the steam bath. For our last treatment, we return to Julian to discuss a report he co-wrote for Autonomy titled Long-Term Care Centres, Making Space for Ageing, which looks at how social design can combat isolation through communal infrastructures of care, such as saunas. When we call for a national spa service, we imagine a sauna, steam bath, or bathhouse in every local community as a space for socialising, of preventative care, and of relaxation away from the demands of work and the distraction of our phones. Autonomy's vision for long-term care centres gives us a more concrete sense of what this could mean.
What the urban team does really is, I guess, more than other parts of the think tank, it really exists at this intersection about the future of work and the end of work, really. And I think that's oddly where saunas keep popping up. And I guess the reason is that it finds itself at this intersection between work and leisure, and it occupies, I guess, a region that we can call reproduction or sort of regeneration of ourselves, of each other, as communities. It's sort of a stand-in for a lot of conversations, and it's almost like this immediate proposal that as soon as you sort of throw it into the mix, everybody instinctively understands what you're trying to get at. So, for example, with this report that we did about long-term care centers, which is a wider report about essentially creating neighborhood infrastructure for long-term care of the body and, let's say, all those diseases that we won't be able, let's say, to cure or to reverse, that simply have to be managed. So our long-term care report was a vision for essentially bringing these practices outside of the home, outside of the hospital, into this sort of third space that would sort of address these needs on a sort of neighborhood and community level. But within that, saunas are an important ingredient. And the way it got into the Daily Express, in fact, they loved it. And the headline was, "Give OAPs saunas to solve care crisis." It was that's what they loved. That's what they wanted. You know, they even put a photo of some aging adults in a sauna, just like a stock image. It was very funny. And all the comments were all thinking about saunas. I'd rather a pub instead of sauna. I'd rather sauna instead of pub. Anyway, but I feel like instinctively everybody understood that what's at stake is actually much wider than simply a sort of mere infrastructure for health, but actually that there are some assumptions about the family, about the body, about intimacy and et cetera, which are actually quite that fundamentally challenge, I think, the privatization or the sort of a very private experience that we might have of washing and of sort of regenerating our bodies. Long-term care centers, they really try to combine two things we tend to know quite well. One is a daycare center for the aged. And the other is a series of support infrastructures for workers. The innovation is in a way combining those two things. And rather than departing from let's say an ideal community that you might want to put together, it's all organized around, let's say, needs and desires of the different subjects that we're interested in bringing into the center. So, for example, part of the center wants to address the needs of precarious care workers by providing them spaces, for example, to change with locker rooms, showers. There's even some nap rooms. kitchenette or the workers in a neighborhood, essentially to have a home away from home, which becomes particularly important if your workplace is somebody else's home. So within all of those infrastructures aimed at workers, we also have a series of infrastructures aimed more specifically at those in need of long-term care and who are experiencing aging. So the infrastructures thought for those subjects are, for example, a community kitchen, a garden, a cafe, an events space with gym, and finally a sauna. And the sauna is actually one of those spaces that are thought both for care workers and for care receivers. In a sense, as that space that really recognizes the reciprocity of these relationships, and that sort of become, and it sort of throws into this infrastructure that would otherwise be almost medical. It instead, I think the element of the sauna and a few other things actually bring an element of joy and desire and the utopian idea that every neighborhood has a sauna which is accessible to everybody. I think there is a lot there. It is the kind of Trojan horse that has the potential to revolutionize our relationship to each other's bodies in a way that we might not expect.
We're grateful to Autonomy for their support in making this series. To find out about their planning for the future of work and hence what our leisure time will look like, head to autonomy.work. TWT is committed to providing radical political education to build a world transformed, but we need your help. So please subscribe to this podcast, tell your friends, and consider becoming a supporter of the organisation by visiting theworldtransformed.org. Together, we can imagine, demand, and build a world transformed.